Welcome to Out of School. This is a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears and I'm joined this evening, as always, by Bradley Chambers. Tonight we have one sponsor, which is our friends at Jam Software, makers of the Casper Suite, which just got upgraded to version 9 2 days ago. So we've been enjoying upgrading to that over the past 24 hours. So good evening, Bradley. How are you?
Living the dream.
I was living the Casper dream today, upgrading to 9, which is...
So you're going to roll with it for the new year.
I have done it, but I have a snapshot of my old version just in case. Not that upgrades ever go wrong in software or anything.
Well, yeah, that was, you know, when you and I were talking yesterday about it, and really it comes down to, do you want to be behind on day one, or do you want to be potentially face, you know, a minor bug? I mean, it's likely that you won't have a showstopper bug, but you might have a little quirk. And so, you know, I don't know. It's a tough call. I mean, the kind of the bleeding edge guy in me always wants to be on the latest and greatest, but then you've also got to like say, well, this is working stable as it is. Let's just wait it out. So it's a tough call.
Well, you're talking to the guy who once administered macOS 10 Server 1.0, which...
That worked great.
Anyway, Bradley, you have trailed this episode for a couple of weeks now, so why don't you tell us what this thing is that we have never talked about before that we're going to talk about tonight?
We have two guests with us tonight, so this will be a four-person show. We have Kevin Rogers and Todd McDonald from a school that is unique to Out of School because they are a Nexus 7 deployment, and they are from the Hillsborough Township Public Schools in New Jersey. So we're excited that they're here. We're going to talk about really what it's like to deploy a Google device in education. So, Todd, Kevin, how's it going?
It's going great. Thanks for having us on.
Yeah, very good. Thank you.
So tell us a little bit about your school. How many students do you have? What grades are you? And just kind of give us a little background on where you guys are at.
Sure. So we have 9 schools. We're a pretty big township in New Jersey. Approximately 7,500 students and about 700 teachers. As far as our school breakdown, there are 6 elementary schools, which is from kindergarten through 4th grade. We have 1 intermediate school, which is grades 5 and 6, 1 middle school, which is grades 7 and 8, and a high school that is grades 9 through 12. So our K-4 is about 3,000 students. And like you alluded to earlier, those students are equipped with their own Nexus tablet for use in the classroom. And our students from grades 5 through 12, we're rolling out a one-to-one program with Chromebooks at the upper grades. And currently this year, it's about 20% of that population that will be issued a Chromebook. And next year, for the 2014-2015 school year, we expect to put a Chromebook in the hands of all of our students in grades 5 through 12, which is about 4,500 students. So that's where we are with, you know, our overall district size and our technology rollouts.
So why the Nexus 7 particularly?
Well, Google recognized us kind of as a potential partner. They were looking for some pilot districts and schools, and we were already a pretty well-known Google Apps district, mostly with our work on the Chromebook and some of our work at local conferences and events. So when we heard they were interested, we certainly were interested too, and we became a partner with them, and they actually provided us with the 3,000 Nexus tablets in exchange for getting feedback from us and us testing out how this is going to actually work in a larger setting. So I think they had done a few pilots previously with smaller schools. They did like a classroom of 30, a school of 300, and then we were the big test of about 3,000 devices. So it kind of, we certainly looked at other tablets in the past, and we have had iPads in district, we had some Android tablets. The Nexus 7 was, you know, fairly new, and we had looked into getting a few of them. And then this kind of came out of left field for us, and you know, we were ready to pounce on this.
That's interesting. So you came to this from first being Google Apps, and then Chromebook, and then Nexus. Is that, if I get that right?
Yeah, pretty much. We've been a Google Apps district for several years now, and last year was our first big push with Chromebooks. And that kind of, we get a lot of different contacts in the area and with Google and Google's different departments, and that kind of helped us forge this relationship with the Android team. And that's how we were selected for this pilot.
And just, we're talking here about this is the original Nexus 7, not the most recent one, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. So give me an idea of what that kind of process looked like from how much, when you're rolling out these devices, how much does being a Google App School help you become an Android tablet school?
Kevin, you take that one?
Well, the biggest part is already having the user accounts populated in the Google directory. So when a student goes to sign into the tablet, they're using a username and password that they're already familiar with.
Okay.
So that's one of the simplest things from a use case point of view.
That's interesting. That was one of the reasons why we at our school recently heavily adopted Google Drive as kind of nearline storage for our iPads, was because, well, we were kind of playing them off against Dropbox, and we realized that, well, it's already built in, and also the quota was much, much higher as well. So it's been a really nice service for us. So that's really interesting to see how that comes along.
We noticed when we were doing a pilot last year where we were doing Chromebooks, and then another group of students were using iPads, and we had a couple of evenings where the students came in to pick devices, and the students who picked up their Chromebooks, they picked up the Chromebook, they signed in with their Google account, everything was good, and they went home within 10 minutes, and then we had a lot of issues on the iPad side because of the Apple ID. But some students, they were told ahead of time to get an Apple ID, but some didn't do it. Some didn't remember the account. Some thought they were going to use their parents' account. And we had some students there for a few hours trying to get the Apple ID straightened out before they could take the device home. So just to reiterate how having that Google Apps account integration already set up was really helpful in streamlining the process.
Yeah, there's no doubt that's something that schools have to grapple with. I mean, I'm facing that problem on Monday. We're recording here on a Thursday night, and on Monday I'm going to have exactly that situation where I'm probably going to have 50, 60 and so on. We've tried to do our best to kind of get people to do things in advance, not necessarily make the Apple ID, but I've tried to figure out, well, how many am I actually facing that don't have an Apple ID? How many do have an Apple ID? And we'll try and route them off into different classrooms depending on what they've got to be helped, or just to pick up the device and go. But I guess the beauty of having Google Apps be the account backend for that is that you've just got carte blanche over the whole thing, right? You can just make as many as you want.
And we have control over the password. We can reset the password if we need to. The student can change their password within our Active Directory, and then that gets synchronized back to Google. Whereas with the Apple ID, you're really reliant on the student to take care of their password issues and working with Apple if they need to, which can be challenging to do.
That's an issue that we have, even with our staff, that, you know, they want to use iCloud for various things, and even if it's not even password-related issues, but it's a document that's not syncing properly, they come to me for help, and there's just only so much I can do because I don't control the account. And so you kind of feel bad telling them, like, well, go to Apple support. And they look at me like, well, that's your job. But they don't quite get it. It's like, well, but I don't, you know, you're in charge of your account. They won't even talk to me.
Yeah, I'm doing this podcast from my classroom, and one of the things I have on my desk here is I have a sheet called the Apple ID Setup Sheet, which is a form that I'm going to have everybody fill in saying, what did you put in security questions? Just write this down, and I'm going to put this in the safe here just in case.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah. It's definitely something that I've wanted for a while on the Apple side, and I mean, we're a Google Apps school as well at Cedars, and I kind of very much enjoy that level of control you have on the back end there, just to basically do what you want, which is nice.
Right. It's just simple. You can just, if they have a password problem, you just reset it right there from the main interface. It's very, very nice. And we've been a Google Apps school since 2010, and it really just kind of works. It's very simple, and it really gets the job done.
And we still maintain a quantity of iPads in district. There are a lot of our special education students use an iPad, and some of the faculty and administrators will have an iPad. So we'll still have probably 150 to 200 iPads in use. And the interesting thing there is that they're all kind of specialized cases, and there are the three or four different ways that you can manage those devices, whether it's with an MDM or you use the Apple configurator or to supervise them or not to supervise them. So it's going to be interesting on how we manage those different sets of devices. And some of them can take up a lot of time depending on if they need new apps installed and who's in control of the Apple ID on that device and other types of things.
Yeah, it's always a big, big question. You know, I was actually just talking to somebody before I came on onto the show here, and she was asking me, well, we've got these... She works at a special needs school in the town. She said, well, we've got these 10 iPads, but you know, one's being run by a teacher's Apple ID and one's being run by something else, you know. So it may be a case of going in there one day and just saying, look, let's just start this all over again and do it this way.
Yeah.
Guys, can we talk a little bit about the hardware? Because I'm interested in this one from two points of view. One, how has reliability and durability and damage rates been for you? And the second question is a little more to do with how are you finding a 7-inch tablet as opposed to a larger thing? But let's talk about durability and damage and so on first. How has that gone?
I don't know that I have any numbers on the Nexus 7, but I know that there weren't too many issues with the Nexus tablets. Now, in our K4 model, every homeroom has a cart for storage. So students are, you know, putting them back on the cart when they're not using them. They were very careful. Then we had very few things break as far as, you know, hardware damage. The Chromebooks were kind of a different story. We actually had probably closer to, you know, 18 and 20% damage rate on the Chromebooks. And mostly because the model that we had, the original Series 5 model, the charging port was at a very poor place and it would snap off frequently. So we had a lot of damage in the exact same spot with that model. We've had a few issues with the hinges and screens breaking, things like that. The trade-off there with the Chromebooks is they're interchangeable. You know, there's nothing stored on the devices. So that was a trade-off we were kind of okay with as far as the classroom side, because we could get a device back in a student's hands within 2 minutes if there was a break. If an iPad broke or even if a Nexus 7 broke, it was a bit more complicated to get that device set up again and personalized for that student.
That's really interesting. Actually, I hadn't really put two and two together with that in Chromebooks, but that's interesting.
It's like you just walk around and you can play musical chairs with laptops. It doesn't even matter which one you get; you just sign in and you're good to go.
Yeah, exactly.
Is there anything stored in Chromebooks at all? Is it literally just a pass field or?
There is. I mean, there's some local storage for like local downloads and things like that, but it's really all synced to your Chrome profile and all and everything you have stored with the, you know, with Google and in the cloud. So
there's nothing you can't recreate if you want to.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we've never had to go back and restore anything from the local storage for students. It's really just a place for like temporary downloads and things like that.
That's pretty compelling, actually, isn't it?
An interesting problem comes about that if you're using Chromebooks in a cart situation, so in a shared model where you have a cart of 15 Chromebooks and numerous students are going to use each one, we found that it does keep enough local storage for each user that eventually that gets filled up and then it starts to generate errors. So that subsequent logins give an error that reads something along, not enough room to load your profile, and the student's apps wouldn't load each time. And I contacted Google, and there's a setting you can apply to a group of devices that will erase all the local usage data every time someone logs out or the machine powers off and back on. So that eliminated that problem. And subsequent updates may have alleviated that even more, but it's been a while since we've had anything reported on that end.
That's really interesting.
We didn't know that was going to happen at all. Didn't even think about it. So now in the Google Apps control panel, you know, we actually have OUs for different groups of devices. So in our cart group, it always wipes at the device after use. So it's always a fresh, you know, brand new device when a student logs in. But our one-to-one program, we don't want that, because every time you get a Chromebook that's fresh, it still wants you to walk through, you know, welcome to your Chromebook and all these steps. So we have to keep those in a separate, you know, OU in the back end.
Okay.
And every once in a while, we get one that's in the wrong OU, so a staff member might report, you know, every time I log in, it reloads all my apps and all my settings. Like, it doesn't remember who I am. And so we just move them into the other OU and synchronize, and then it's back to regular usage.
That's nice. So you found that adopting Chromebooks was a very, given that you're already a Google Apps school, then adopting Chromebooks is very much a straightforward step just beyond that.
Oh, yeah, it couldn't be easier. As far as the, you know, for the students, you know, it's ideal. You know, we want them to have, you know, quick access to log on. We had netbooks in the past, and, you know, pulling down their profiles just, you know, would take, you know, 5 to 10 minutes sometimes. You know, we're kind of piecing together some old machines and trying to get, you know, extend the life as long as you can. With the Chromebooks, you know, these kids can log on. They're on in 10 seconds.
It's interesting. We actually we still have a range of MacBooks from our sort of previous life as a Mac school, I suppose. And one of the things I did last year was I said, forget this login stuff. I just put them all into guest mode and said, look, these are kind of like an iPad. Just MD can use them sort of thing. And it's almost like a Chromebook model, except they didn't keep any data. And that, was, right. that took my intervention rate on those laptops down from more than 100 iPads for these 10 laptops down to basically zero for the whole year. Really nice.
That's great.
Talk to us about like the purchase process for apps on the Nexus 7. Like, what's it like buying those? Do they have a way to buy those in bulk? And how do you actually distribute those?
So what happens is we issue a purchase order to Google for a certain amount of money, and then that gets loaded into our account. So similar to, I guess, the Apple Volume Purchase Program, where we in the U.S. buy vouchers and then upload it to an account. So once the money is stored in the account, you give access to a group of users. You know, you can just give it to administrators, or you can give it down to the teacher level so that they have funds available to them that they can use to purchase apps. And then they'll log in to the Google Play for Education. They'll have a credit of money that they can purchase, browse for an app, and then purchase a quantity of them, and then actually deploy them to a group of users.
Okay, and then once you've done that, are those, when you deploy it, say, to 10 students or 20 students, are those apps able to be reallocated the year after, or are they kind of locked into those students' accounts, same as they are on iOS?
That's a great question. Unfortunately, I don't know the answer to that one.
No, actually, I do know the answer to that.
Okay.
Perfect. They are locked in. You are locked in, and it is apply it to that student's account. So that student moves on to, you know, fourth grade next year. They still retain that app for the following year.
Okay, so it's basically the same model as iOS in that respect.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. Do you guys do anything to do with if you have like maybe two teachers teaching the same grade, is there any process for making sure that they're both using the same app for the same thing? Or do you just let each teacher sort of have carte blanche on that?
They really, they do have full, you know, carte blanche for that. We took a very simplified approach to rolling the tablets out last year. You know, partially it was deliberate because they are fairly easy to use and intuitive, and partially because, you know, we just didn't have the time. You know, this Nexus 7 program came up with only a few months to roll out. We had to roll them out towards the end of the school year. We rolled them out, I think, in May.
Okay.
So contrast that with our one-to-one program at the upper grades. It's a four-year, you know, phase-in program, 10% 1 year, 20% the next year, full scale. So that program, we've had, you know, scaffolded training. You know, and my job as the technology integration specialist is focusing a lot on the professional development for teachers. So we've been doing a lot of training over the last few years trying to, you know, get our users comfortable with Google Apps as their main, you know, productivity suite. When the Nexus 7s came, we really didn't have the time to come up with a plan for rollout and training. So we did pretty simple device training, and then we did some brief training on how to actually find your apps, you know, in the Google Play for EDU store. And the Play for EDU store is incredibly powerful. Teachers can actually, you know, search. They have different drop-down menus for subjects, grade levels, intended use, and even content standard. So it's, you know, from the tech side, there's a lot of things we really wouldn't know so much about which apps we want to push to them, and we're kind of relying on the buildings to share with each other. And, you know, they have PLC time, that's the professional learning community, so they can, you know, talk about what apps are working great for them, and then we try to share that with other schools. That's one thing this year we definitely want to do a better job of, is trying to, you know, make sure that we can capture those best practices and share them with other buildings. Since we do have six schools that are all kind of have their own culture, and we need to try to find ways to make it so it's consistent learning across the board.
Interesting. Yeah. It's so valuable, that the idea of getting that information from teachers to other teachers. And I think you've seen this certainly, and we've seen it as well. And Bradley, I know you've seen it as well, that the shift that's happened in the past sort of 5 years from being the IT people who sort of decide the software load down to it being the individual teachers that decide the software load, that's, I don't think everybody's really appreciated just how important that is. Would you guys agree with that?
Oh, it's huge. Absolutely huge. Last June, for the first time, we actually issued laptops to teachers. And it was a huge shift because we actually did give them full admin rights. And I haven't been in the district that long, so, you know, I wasn't familiar quite with the culture, but teachers were quite shocked to learn that they could actually install their own software. And now it's become the norm. And teachers know if they have a problem, they get re-imaged and they'll have to reinstall their software. But we want them to get comfortable. We want them to explore. We don't want them to be afraid to touch things, break things. So we've seen that it's kind of changed the culture a bit. You know, anywhere you walk around in our, any of our schools, if teachers are on, you know, prep or duty periods, you see them, you know, with their laptops in front of them working. It's a huge shift, you know, just like you said.
It's fantastic. It's great. Let's talk a little bit about the sort of sysadmin issues that go in behind some of these things. We've already talked about the ease of adoption in a Google Apps school and so on, of Chromebooks and then of Nexus 7. Obviously, one of the things that people kind of, the stick that people beat Android with a lot is the issue of operating system updates and the promptness or otherwise of those. And I know that Nexus devices are sort of at the front of the queue for some of that stuff, but have you found that to be straightforward, or have you found it any kind of road bumps along the way there?
Yeah, for the most part, the devices have been receiving the regular updates, and there's nothing that we have to maintain internally to manage the devices. Everything is handled through the Google Apps domain control panel dashboard. And I have a test Nexus 7 just to make sure things are working and to see what's going on with them. And a few weeks ago, it received the latest update. And one of the fixes in that update is supposed to deal with the issue of the flash memory problem, where the flash memory degrades over time and the device gets slower and slower. So that was something I read about, and I started to get nervous thinking, well, we've got these tablets now that we intend to use for a few years. Are they going to be really slow in 6 months or a year's time? And then what do we do in that case? Because a device that's difficult to use won't get used. So hopefully we haven't had any issues reported. Again, the devices are still fairly new for us, having only received them earlier this year. But I'm hopeful that they'll continue to work well for us for the next couple of years. But yeah, I've had no issues reported with any of the updates or anything.
Okay, that's great. And apps are basically handled the same way, right? It's almost as if you just had your own Nexus 7 and you were talking directly to the store, right?
Yep, once they're installed, exactly. Yep.
Yeah, cool.
And I think, you know, one of the things that it seems like Google is trying to build an end-to-end solution here and, you know, do everything, you know, try to streamline that process, you know, really for the teacher to be able to do as much as possible.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the teachers can now, you know, choose their own apps and push them to their classes, even just to try them out. You know, again, is a big shift from, you know, what you're used to. I mean, the majority of apps teachers have been using were also free. So we did have some money allocated, you know, for app purchasing. But I think that, you know, something like 70% of the apps, you know, in the Play for EDU store are free apps. So teachers can often try things first, try them with students. And then if they really like it, you know, and they get limited, then they can put in that request, you know, to have some funds dispersed and get that, you know, newer app or the paid app in the students' hands. But for the most part, the free versions, you know, work quite well, and teachers were trying, you know, so many. I mean, we can't even keep track of how many apps we were using. But Google reported back to us, we had something to the effect of like 90% of our devices were used every single day in the classroom. And this is a program, like I said, it was introduced towards the end of the school year during kind of a crunch time around, you know, testing in the, you know, late April, May. And with very little training, there was still the adoption rate was really impressive. Considering that there's a lot already on teachers' plates, and we just said, oh, here are these tablets we're going to add in your classrooms too, and we'd like you to use them as much as you can. And we didn't force them. We didn't have any real expectation of use other than, you know, try things. We're here to help you. And we really did see, you know, fantastic adoption, and the enthusiasm level from teachers and students was very, very high.
That's great. It's certainly, it feels to me almost like a feature of new one-to-one deployments is a real, you know, sharp increase in the number of apps that get used and the range and diversity of apps that get used. And it'd be interesting to hear from you guys maybe in a year or so if that changes for your teachers, because one of the things we're seeing now is that I've just got done redeploying a whole set of apps for next year, and what we've seen actually is that teachers want many fewer apps now than they did before. But the apps that they want are the apps that are enabling creativity, and they're enabling students to kind of express themselves and make their own things, but they're also much more powerful applications than they were before. So it'll be interesting to see how that develops for you guys as well.
Yeah, I think you know that's exactly what you know we expect to see too. So we've been in these pilot you know phases now for quite some time, and even this year I'm seeing a difference in our training. We're now trying to I wouldn't say standardize, but we have a few recommended you know tools that we really want to focus on for the reasons that you mentioned. You know, we try to stress to our teachers that the technology is not the learning outcome here. You know, your end goal should not be just to use tablets or to use Chromebooks. What do you want your students to do? And once you start doing that, teachers start to find those really good apps that let students, you know, collaborate more and create things and express themselves and start conversations, you know, convince somebody that, you know, you're right and, you know, they need to reevaluate their opinions. So we're trying to, you know, our training really doesn't focus so much on the tech side. We introduce a few different tools, but we try to focus on what their goals should be in the classroom. And we have three technology goals in our district that kind of help us stay on track with that. Mm-hmm. And for me as a technology integration specialist, it's really critical that all my training links to our three technology goals. And teachers also can know if they're on track with what we would consider to be, you know, very successful technology integration. And one of those goals is globalizing the curriculum. We want teachers to, you know, as often as they can, reach out, connect to people, you know, outside of the classroom, outside of the country. You're learning about China in school. Let's find a class to connect to in China so we can have some, you know, rich discussion, you know, about, you know, what you're learning and, you know, really expand, you know, your classroom walls. Another one of our goals is asynchronous learning. So we want teachers to always consider, you know, ways to get students learning at any time, any place. That's an expectation that, you know, we all have in the workplace now, and we're starting to see more and more of that from students. It may well be that 7:30 in the morning is not the optimal time to learn Algebra 1, you know, for a 15-year-old. So as a teacher, you know, can you find a way to make sure that the students are getting the resources they need, the content they need at a time and place that they can, you know, learn best? And that's, you know, our second goal. And our third technology goal is the one that I think we meet, you know, most often. It's that we want students to be the ones that are creating, collaborating, and publishing digital content. And that's where you start to get the really, you know, rich creations of students. The creativity shines. You choose your own topics. You choose your own projects. You, you know, choose who you work with. And we're seeing, you know, again, it mirrors the real world. You know, in the real world, you know, that's, you know, collaboration. And for many years in education, collaboration was called cheating. You know, and we want to encourage these kids to, you know, work together. It's okay to solve these problems together. So, you know, I think we've done a lot of, you know, site visits and conferences, and one thing that we really try to stress in our district is, you know, this is not just about technology. This is about enhancing the learning, you know, for these students. You know, technology has a potential to provide experiences that you otherwise couldn't have, and that's really what we try to focus. So I do expect this year that we'll get some teachers to start to break through and meet those goals in ways that, you know, I could never, you know, imagine to do training on. And hopefully they'll be able to, you know, turnkey that to their peers, and we'll start to see, you know, some more growth in those areas.
You know, it's really, if you think about what we all do with technology, we have that same goal. If you look at an app like Evernote, you could do all of that functionally with manila envelopes or, you know, some sort of paper-based system. But when you can use technology, it enhances that process. So you're still organizing things, but it's allowing you to do search and you know, so many more things. And so that's really, you know, you always figure out your solution, what you want, and let's like work backwards and plug in the technology.
Right. Yep.
Before we move on, let's take a second and thank our sponsor for this week. It's Jamp Software. I've been with us for a few weeks. They make the great Casper suite. Jamp provides ICT staff with enterprise tools that power widespread use of Apple technologies in education. Now with Casper Focus, they have placed these powerful technologies directly into the hands of the teachers that work with the students every day. Casper Focus enables teachers to unlock the full potential of the iPad in the classroom by ensuring all students are engaged on the same activity and using their iOS devices in the way that it was intended. Learn more at jampsoftware.com. And if you're a current customer of the Casper suite, the version 9 has just been released, so it's got some neat changes. I think, Fraser, one of the things you showed me yesterday was the iPhone optimized web view. So if you're out actually in the classroom, you can actually work with your Casper suite from your phone. Talk to us a little bit about your network design. Talk to us about your back end, you know, LAN, your firewall, switches, security device, and, you know, and talk about Wi-Fi and really, and then some of the transitions you guys had to make when you went to a really you know, devices that were Wi-Fi only, when Wi-Fi is the first layer of access.
Sure. So we have 9 schools. We actually have 10 buildings to include our Board of Education office. And years ago, when the cable company came to outfit the town with cable television, part of the agreement they made with the township was to run fiber optic to all the municipal buildings. So we're very lucky that we have gigabit fiber connections to each of our buildings that come back into our high school, and that's where we maintain our main data center. And we're using HP ProCurve switches, and we have the 5412 series at the district core. We also have one at the high school core, and then I have another 5412 chassis to service our VMware farm. And then some smaller switches, the 3500 series down at the lower schools. And the nice thing about this is it allows us to centralize everything. So we have a NetApp filer at the high school. So all the local file storage, the, what we call the H drive for the users, and then some other shared Windows shared drives are all housed at the high school, and they can access it from anywhere in the district. And that also allows us to centralize the firewall. So the interesting thing about the firewall is, because we have so many more devices now, we've more than tripled the number of concurrently connected devices we have within the last year and a half. The firewall model that we had is no longer sufficient to handle that amount of traffic. So this summer, one of the projects I had was to upgrade to a more robust firewall. And I use a Fortinet FortiGate model, and recently got a 3240C, which is a pretty beefy. It's a 2U, very heavy system as compared to the other one. It's specified to support up to 40 gigabits per second throughput as compared to 8 on the older model. And the latest model can do 10 million concurrent sessions, where the previous version I had installed could only do 600,000. And I've actually seen with the older firewall toward the end of the school year that we were maxing out the resources and we were having some outage issues, because so many people were using the network at the same time, the device just couldn't keep up with that amount of traffic. So that's one of the challenges with adding all of these devices, is that we had to grow the network to respond to that use, those usage scenarios.
Yeah, you know, I hear that story all the time, where the people that are basically approving these purchases, they don't think about the infrastructure to support it. So they'll say, all right, we're going to buy 1,000 iPads or 1,000 laptops. It's like, well, that when you go to a network that size, or 5,000 or 10,000, you have to beef up your network. And it's not even just as simple as adding something. You know, when you start talking a firewall of that size, they're not, on sale at Newegg.com. I mean, these are expensive devices, and kind of plain old switches just don't cut it either. And it's a hard sell, because infrastructure is something that no one sees except if it doesn't work. So I always kind of say it's not a sexy purchase. It's nothing that you when it comes in, people are excited to see it, but it's just, it's kind of like a car engine. You've got to have it, you have to take care of it.
Yeah. I'm excited to see it when these things come in. It's like getting new toys.
Well, we had some new laptops today, and I was swapping some stuff out. And I guess it's, I don't know, maybe I'm jaded, because I've opened up hundreds of laptops in my life, and I don't even care anymore. I'm more complaining about retail boxes. Like, well, I got a Mac Mini in today for something. It's like, I have to open a box, and what is this? Like, give me a simple. I don't want the cool. I don't want the manual. Just I don't know. Send me the cables in a Ziploc bag.
Oh, you're an old man, Bradley.
I know.
What can I say?
Because you opened up 100 iPads and retail boxes. So, if anybody should be complaining, it should be you.
Yeah, but you get that nice smell.
I did that
smell,
a couple years ago. I had the pleasure of doing that. Actually, you know what? I think I did get the reduced packaging when we had a couple hundred iPads come in. And the reduced packaging, I think they put 10 iPads per box. And there's still a lot of cardboard and a lot of tape that you have to cut through, but definitely.
Yeah, they're still shipping as retail boxes here in the UK. So we got them in cartons of 5 retail boxes, basically exactly the same thing that goes to the Apple store, as far as I know. So we spent a lot of time cutting film and ripping sheets off, but we're there now.
Yeah, I think our Nexus 7, I think, was 7 pallets of joy. you know, to open those things up. I mean,
yeah, those are retail packaging.
Yes, through 3,000 and, you know, 3,000, it sounds like a lot. When you see them stack the empty boxes when you're done, I mean, the temptation to just run and jump on it was really tough to resist.
That's when you owe your custodial staff a large tip on those days.
Yes.
Because they're just looking at you like, I already cleaned these up. Why are there more? It's like, I'm sorry. You know, they'll ask, like, do you have more coming? It's like, yeah, we haven't even opened half of them. Sorry. You know, it's like you apologize. You know, I don't know. Talk to us about, you know, your kind of, you know, we've talked previously about your Wi-Fi network. Talk to us kind of about the past and the present and the future of your, you know, of your wireless network.
Sure. When I first came on board, the wireless network we had was set up for just convenience for the staff. So wherever someone said, hey, I'd like to be able to use my own computer from home to get onto the network in this area. So we had a Blue Socket device and some Linksys access points that would just be put wherever there was a request made. And they would get put onto an isolated network and they would log in using their Active Directory credentials and just get isolated guest network out to the internet, and they couldn't touch the internal network. So I guess over the years, we ended up having maybe 50 or 60 access points, and that system worked well. But then we started to do laptop carts, and some of the administrators had their own laptops, and we said, okay, it looks like we're going to have to put in a wireless system that's really more for the production network than for just guest access. So we did a site survey, and we were originally building out for coverage everywhere, not necessarily density, or I guess I should say we were putting in coverage and to support up to 15 devices in a classroom. And the result came out to be about an access point in every other classroom, sort of using that, if you look down a hallway, a sawtooth design. So there's one here, skip one, and then put one in the next classroom. And that worked well for us for about a year. We had coverage everywhere. We didn't have that many wireless devices, you know, a few laptop carts in each school. Administrators had laptops. I had my laptop, which was nice to be able to have one less plug on my desk. And then we started to do the pilot programs. So we did iPads and Android tablets at the upper schools. And we figured, well, we're not going to be able to support that many number of devices with one AP in every other classroom. So then we had to expand. So we ended up having an access point in every classroom at that point at our upper schools in grades 5 through 12. And then we ran with that system for about a year and a half. And then Google came along and donated these tablets for us. And now we had the same problem in the elementary schools where we're going to have 20 to 30 devices per classroom and only half of an access point basically for them to use. And that wasn't going to cut it. So then we had to do another purchase to get an access point in every classroom. And that's where we are right now. So pretty much every classroom district-wide has an access point. And then we've got, you know, two or three in the larger areas like a library or an auditorium. And the one thing that's interesting to me with all this wireless is how many wires actually goes into the deployment and how many times I've had to count available PoE ports in the closets, because I've done this exercise at least two or three times now, and one of these days I'm going to realize, you know, I should write this down and figure out a way to kind of future-proof it, but I can't seem to get it together. So I go in and I'll put in a 24-port PoE switch in a closet to accommodate, you know, a dozen access points going in this wing, and then I learn, oh, we're going to put PoE phones in this school, so then I'm going to need another two dozen ports. And so now that 24-port switch I put in is going to have to get replaced with a 48-port switch. So I've been around to all the closets and putting switches in and taking switches out for the last few years. And I'm hoping now that we've got an AP everywhere and a phone everywhere that this should be sort of the last time I need to do a massive rollout of switching.
Who do you guys use for phones?
We use Cisco.
We've not made the transition to IP-based phones. We're still using – we have a PBX system. We didn't really want to spend the time doing the wiring. It's just – with an old building, it's just the concept of rewiring makes my head spin.
Yeah. We had a pretty old I guess it was a digital system. It wasn't voice over IP, but it was, you know, an old, I forget the manufacturer, but it was an older system and just became unreliable. And then most of the devices were end of support, that we couldn't hardly get support on them. So it was time, and they made room in the budget to upgrade the phone system. And that's been great for us.
So, you know, since you've kind of added this AP, or not kind of, since you've added an AP to every classroom, has that largely solved all of your issues?
It hasn't. And the thing is that I'm sort of coming from the wired network side, which is a lot simpler. There's only a few things to look at if a wired connection isn't working. I mean, first, the obvious, is it plugged in? Is the switch powered on? And then we can look at, is the proper VLAN tag to that port? A few other things, but for the most part, it's either working or it isn't, and there's not too many things that go wrong with the wired connection. With wireless, I've been learning that there are so many more variables that come into play, because we're now talking about the airspace as being a shared medium with other devices. We have things like interference, and then there's different use cases. So do I have a classroom that are all trying to stream a YouTube video at the same time? Is someone running a microwave oven while they're trying to do this? And the learning curve has been pretty interesting for me. And I've made a few mistakes with the current setup we had, because the way we grew our network, where we had just laptop carts originally, I set up an SSID to support those devices. And then we got one-to-one devices, so I had to set up another SSID for those devices. But because of the numbers that I'm dealing with, so I have up to 600 users per grade. So that means I have 2,400 devices at the high school, but I don't want to make a network that is too large. So I kind of have to break up the groups of students to go onto different networks. So I would have grade 12 users connect to one network called, like, say, student one. Then I'd create another network called student two, and that would be the next group of 500 or so users. And then I wanted to make sure I could accommodate users at every grade to be able to go to any building to get onto the network. So what I ended up with in the end is I'm broadcasting probably 12 or 13 SSIDs, which I've since learned is not a very good idea, partly because each one of those SSIDs has to get its time to do its beacons. And Now I've severely reduced the amount of airtime that's available for any one of those networks. So in the last few months, I've been getting a lot of network issues reported. Some users not able to connect, or they're able to connect, but they're getting really slow speeds. Just overall things not working as well as they should. Definitely not as well as they do on the wired side. So the thing I'm looking at now is we just received the shipment of Aerohive units, and they have a feature where I can simplify it by broadcasting only a few SSIDs. So I'll have the primary production network that will be for all my devices. And depending on who the user is who connects and from which device they're connecting, they'll get put into a certain network. So it's sort of a different way to think about the network. So they're just connecting to this SSID, but how I handle their traffic afterward depends on a few factors. So that allows me to simplify things. So I can have 12 different networks behind this SSID, depending on who the user is. If they're bringing their own device, I can use the same network and treat them separately, because I know that, oh, they're coming from a device that I don't manage, so you can get put onto this private network.
I was trying to ask if are you doing this to the user profiles on the SSID?
Yeah, I'm hoping to, actually. Okay. I haven't rolled that out yet. I have my systems engineer coming on Monday to go over some of that stuff. And that's another thing that I wasn't familiar with, is doing the 802.1x authentication. We do that now with some of our wireless networks, and setting up a network policy server to handle that. So there are a lot of things that are different on the wireless side. And I'm hoping that's going to work. So the idea is that the user will use their AD credentials to connect to the network, and then I'm going to capture that information in Radius and then use it to apply web filtering. So that'll be handy.
Yeah, we're doing some similar things with our AirHive network, actually, one of the big changes for us this summer is we've gone from one SSID to two. And the main reason for doing that was actually that when everybody's got their own credentials for the network, I wanted it to be so that the students could only put one device on with that password, but the staff needed to have up to four devices that could use their password. So that's kind of a limitation of AirHive at the moment, I think, is that you still have to, that can only be set on a per SSID basis. So one SSID has 0 to 1 devices, another one has 0 to 4 on it. But beyond that, we're not actually doing anything very different with the traffic at the back end yet. But the joy of it is that, of course, we can make those changes at some point in the future, knowing that everybody's got their own credentials at the moment.
Right. Well, and I think it's a more secure as instead of using a WPA with a pre-shared key, because it's very likely that that key will get out and then all bets are off as far as who can get onto your network with that key.
And the other thing that we're looking at it for is when students leave the school, if they leave during the school year or something like that, we can just revoke their credential without having to touch all the other devices as well. Because previously we had handed out that key through a configuration profile on the iPad. So as far as we know, the students didn't know the key. I'm going to say as far as we know, I don't know for certain that nobody did. But the beauty of that now is that we can just take one user out and the rest is just undisturbed.
Wireless has gone from a nice to have, a convenience, to really your main network. And For our users, if your Wi-Fi is flaky, they think the whole network's flaky. And it could be your switching is great, everything's great, but maybe you've got an RF interference issue in one section of the building. But to that user, the network's down. Because for it to be so simple in terms of it's supposed to be wireless, it's a complicated technology. And you're right, there are a lot of wires to it because the APs still have to have wires.
Yes, indeed. Okay. I actually had one other question that's not in our show outline, but it just came to my mind, gents. What about AV connectivity for both Chromebooks and Nexus devices? We've obviously, on the show, we've talked a lot about Apple TV being a thing for the iOS side. And I don't know if you've made any use of Chromecast yet, but I'm interested to know what you have done and what you plan to do in the future on that.
We haven't done anything with the Chromecast. We did deploy some Apple TVs when we were doing the iPad pilot, and we had to kind of overcome the challenges of that being the requirement to have them on the same network. And originally I thought that I would put the Apple TV on the staff's iPad network, but they came back and said it's actually more useful for us if the students can project their material on the screen rather than the teacher. So then I switched the Apple TV to the student network. We use a thing called Hipara Teacher Dashboard with the Chromebooks, and that's sort of a Google Docs, Google Apps integration. It takes information from our student information system and creates class groups and assigns those groups to the different staff members who are teaching those classes, and the students can upload documents. And one of the features it has from the Chromebook side is the teachers can monitor what's on the screen of any one of the students, and then they can actually push a web page to any one of the screens. I don't think they can do real-time uploading, but they can do a screenshot of someone's screen and then bring it up on a projector. We have LCD projectors in all of our classrooms, and some of them are they can wirelessly project from their laptops, so that we have Lenovo tablet laptops for the teachers. And I think it's an Epson branded projector, and there's software on there that allows them to wirelessly project the image on their screen. But as far as projecting the Nexus tablet or the Chromebook, we have to go back to a dongle. So on the Chromebook, there's a VGA dongle that they would have to unplug their PC that's connected to the projector and then plug it into the Chromebook. We'll probably look. I think we've ordered a couple of Chromecast devices, so we'll experiment with that a little bit. I think that has some interesting use cases for us.
We've just come off having iPad 1 for all of our students, and we're just about to roll out fourth generation iPad next week. But one of the sort of bizarre tricks, sort of ghetto tricks that I found the kids doing in school was you can AirPlay from an iPad 1 from the videos app and also from the photos app. So instead of showing their actual live screen on the projector on the Apple TV, what the kids would do would be to take a screenshot of whatever they wanted to show and then switch to the photos app and AirPlay a static screenshot from the photos app so they could show the class what they were doing. But it was a kind of a low-rent workaround you had to do in iPad 1.
Your seniors that are graduating are going to tell horror stories and when they get to college. Like, it's like we were in high school, we had to take a screenshot of our work and put it in the photos app, and that's how we had to AirPlay because our iPads were so old. Didn't even have a camera on it.
And we enjoyed it.
What do you guys, I mean, I guess as we get wrapping up the show, what do you guys like about being basically a Google school from end to end? You know, Fraser and I both are Google app schools, but we use a lot of Apple products, so we kind of have our feet in both camps. I mean, you guys are Google through and through. So tell us about the positives and negatives about that.
Well, I guess I should say first, though, that I'm not necessarily ingrained in the Google lifestyle. I use a Mac. I have an iPhone. I have an iPad. So I'm very much, you know, interested in the Apple technology. So it's kind of interesting. And interesting to me, I think I'm one of two Macs that are in use in the district. But I might be the only one now, though. My supervisor switched to a Chromebook Pixel. So, but I'm not anti-Google in any way. You know, I do see a lot of the benefits. The one big one for schools is that there's no cost to us, and no monetary cost, at least. And the other big thing I like is the integration with our Active Directory and the way that that allows us to simplify the user management. So we do most of our user management in Active Directory is automated off of our student information system. So there's rarely a time I have to create a user manually, and the password gets synchronized. So that's been a real big help.
Yeah, and I think Kevin mentioned that Hapara Teacher Dashboard product. We also are integrating VoiceThread this year also. So, you know, with the Google Marketplace apps, you know, you can also use the same Google authentication. So, again, we're looking at this single sign-in for students and teachers to have access to as many things as possible. In our pilot program, that was one of the consistent concerns we had from parents was because teachers had so much free rein to go and try new things, students were having trouble keeping track of all the usernames and passwords, you know, that they need. So, you know, this year we made a pretty strong effort to try and synchronize, you know, across the board with, you know, with Google Apps, which, as Kevin said, is synchronized with AD.
I was just going to ask, with the Chromebook experience, when you go to, say, like third-party services, do you find that most of them support Google Login? Or because I had a Chromebook for a while on loan from a friend, and one of the things I found was that when I went to the Chrome store and then I went to, you know, install an app, as you do, then I had to make an account with this thing that does diagrams, then I had to have another account with this thing. Are you finding that more and more of those things are also taking a Google login as well?
Yeah, definitely. In the last few months, there's been a lot more than we had seen even last summer when we did our training. And if you're in your Google Drive now, if you click on the Create button, there's a little link to connect apps to Drive. And that brings up a special filter of apps that are integrated with your Google Drive. So it will use the same login. And then even better, if you do go ahead and create like a video using one called WeVideo, for example, it'll actually save the file, the WeVideo editing files, in your Google Drive. So that's a huge advantage for us, especially on Chromebooks, because we do want to use, just like you said before, we want to use Drive for as much of our file storage as we can. And then Kevin mentioned the features of the Hapara Teacher Dashboard as far as some of the remote control type features where you can see what students are doing, open links for them. But for our teachers, the greatest benefit of a program like that is it automatically, well, we kind of set up to this, but it'll read our information system and create all of our class groups. So it automates the entire folder sharing structure. So every student has a folder for every single class that they're enrolled in. A teacher has this special dashboard view through this product where they can see all 25 students in one place. And you could easily, you know, see grade student work. So for students, whenever they can store something in their Drive, they could put it in their class folder, and that becomes like their Dropbox for class where they can hand in their work. So that we rolled out probably mid-year last year, and a lot of our training this summer is focused on getting the most out of, you know, this program and take advantage of how well synchronized it is with Google and with Google Apps.
That sounds great. And what it's doing there is it's making native folders in Google Drive, but it's just doing it in an automated fashion.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So the student experience is the same as it is normally in Drive, but you already have your folders named for you and shared with the teacher correctly through Google Groups that we create from our information system. So that's been it's a huge help, especially as we move forward with Chromebooks. That's going to be, you know, it's such little training for students. Put it in your class folder is all you need to tell them. There's also a feature in this HAPARA program, and HAPARA is HAPARA, where a teacher can actually create a document and they can actually blast a copy to every single student in a class. So you can create a worksheet, blast the students. All the student has to do is open that, type in the answers, and close it. And it's already been created, named, and shared back with the teacher through the correct system. So we've seen, I'd say it's the only, you know, real technology tool that we've ever rolled out to teachers that teachers have reported back to us. That was a time saver, like, from the get-go. Hmm. Other, you know, usually it takes a little bit of a learning curve to figure out, how am I going to use this? Where do I squeeze it in? This is a typical productivity type tool. We use it, you know, every single day, and it requires such little training and setup that, you know, we're good to go. So that's a huge advantage for us. And that's, you know, that's part of, I think, us being so ingrained, you know, with Google as far as, you know, Chromebooks and Google Apps. So that's a big push for us. And like I mentioned earlier, another, you know, big like for me about being, you know, in with Google across the board, and I focus more on the Chromebook program, is again how the devices are mostly interchangeable. So the lack of, you know, the customization you do to the physical device is huge for us, because we know that in a fairly large district, we still need less manpower to swap out devices to make sure that the learning is not interrupted.
Yeah, that's a story that I hear more and more from schools that are looking at Chromebooks and are using them. There's a couple of schools in Scotland that are doing that as well. And that's one thing they always say is, you know, it just rolls on, you know, updates, no problem, disaster recovery, trivial, you know, is really compelling, particularly for schools. At least in this area, one of the features of the way that IT is usually managed in this area is that most schools don't have anybody in the building at all who can do that kind of stuff. And they're either doing it remotely or they're kind of getting in a van and driving around one school a day during the week or whatever. But I think more and more that can be pretty compelling for a lot of districts that manage their IT that way, particularly for rural areas as well in Scotland. Okay, so why don't you tell us, are there places on the web where people can sort of follow along with what you're learning and what you're doing?
Probably the district website is the best place. Sometimes they'll post news on there, and the web address is www.htps.us. And I realized shortly after we signed up for that domain name how similar it sounds to HTTPS. I thought it was going to be really cool to have we're going from our old domain name was hillsborough.k12.nj.us, which is a mouthful. Sometimes it's confusing to read to people on the phone what you know, like my email address ends in at https.us and people get confused, but most people seem to find it okay.
Once they realize it stands for Hillsborough Township Public Schools, it tends to click.
Okay, yeah. Great. Well, guys, thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate you giving us your time.
Yeah, you're welcome. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you.
Bradley, let people know where they can find you as well.
At Bradley Chambers on Twitter and on the web at chambersdaily.com.
And I am Fraser Spears on Twitter, spears.org on the web. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll talk to you all next week.